This is Kevin Conroy, and you're listening to The Drift Space.
Initiating neural magic in 3, 2, 1.
You know what I had the strongest urge to watch the other day? Evil Dead.
Well, that's nowhere close to what we're talking about today.
Well, no, actually it is, because the last time you and I had a bonus episode, we were talking about sword and sorcery movies, and I brought up Army of Darkness, and I was like, since I started watching Evil Dead, I was like, you know what, let's roll the ball. Let's watch all of them. I have forgotten. Like, you know, I was watching him, and I was like, I love Jim Carrey, but Bruce Campbell can give him a run for his money with some of the expressions he makes in those movies.
He's fairly rubber-faced. Yeah.
He is. Like, that scene in the second movie where he, that the house is driving him mad, and he just starts losing his mind, and he just laughs uncontrollably.
And see, the second movie's my favorite, so yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, well, the first movie is like, okay, yeah, I see Remy's beginnings in it, but like the second movie is just a recap of the first movie with fewer people. I mean, let's be honest.
And more really shenanigans, more of like the Raimi Weevil we like know.
With the where he opens up like where the chainsaw is supposed to be, and there's just an outline, a chalk outline. He's like, yeah. Chainsaw! Welcome to another bonus episode of The Drift Space, everybody. Today, GJ and I continue our discussion on Ultraman G. We're doing episodes 6 through 10 this time. You know, I think the further we get into this show, the more it thickens like a fine soup.
Like a fine soup?
Yes. The plot thickens like a good soup.
A good soup? Is this your shrubbery?
I don't... No, that's actually my next Fanboy 50. Talking about how Ben and I went for a walk and I got to look at all the lovely shrubbery.
Shrubbery. You know, I'm kind of glad you decided, hey, let's dive back into Ultraman Jeet again, because I've been watching Ultra Galaxy lately. And I don't get me wrong, I like Ultra Galaxy, but it doesn't have the visual inventiveness of some other Ultra series that we've been watching lately. I think, you know, there was a point where Tsuburaya, the production company of the Ultraman series, they were embroiled in a legal battle with Chiyo. And just how long that went on was really, really eating into their shows that they were producing. And you can tell with this one, it's not like that. I really like the characters. They're very likable, in some ways more likable than the ones that we're about to talk about. And I think the concept for Ultra Galaxy is fantastic, but it's kind of just a barren looking show.
I agree. So, cause I just started Ultra Galaxy myself.
Yeah, I miss the miniatures, and even if, you know, we don't have traditional like buildings and whatnot, there's been plenty of instances where when, you know, Ultra Warriors and Kaiju are fighting in the countryside, we get those really cool kind of shots from these miniature trees that are sort of setting the scale in the foreground and stuff like that. We don't get any of that here. And
yeah.
And you know, it's fine. It's a fine show. It really is. But it's not popping like Ultraman Jeed, which was kind of a nice breath of fresh air after getting through Ultra Galaxy, which just kind of drags.
Yeah, you know, there's an episode where it took place in space. And maybe I'm watching the one after it. I may not be watching Galaxy, but
are you watching season 2 of it?
It might be season two, where they had a clone of Zero.
Oh, I think you're watching.
You're watching. It's the latest one that Mills Creek came out with.
Yeah. Oh shoot. What is it called? It's basically the Ultraman Zero set, right?
Yeah.
I know.
Ultra fight. Yeah, same thing applies with that one, because it took place in space, and it was just kind of barren. There was nothing real exciting about the environment other than just, you know, ooh, space.
Yeah, I would argue Ultra Galaxy is even worse on that front. It's just, it's very brown, barren, very little green, very little shrubbery.
No, Rebecca would be disappointed.
The monsters are cool and everything, but monster fights can only do so much without kind of that color and that depth of field and cinematography that we're used to. But we are talking about a series that has a lot of that today. So should we dive in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do this. All right. Episode 6, So That I Can Be Me. After Zero and Leto transform to help Jid, the mild-mannered family man suddenly finds the prospect of being an Ultraman exciting. Riku doesn't appreciate the insinuation that being a hero is full of fun and games, so the two decide to trade roles to figure out who has it rougher. Whoever wrote this, I don't really appreciate the use of the word rougher. I have a fundamental issue with the word. Is that even a word? Hold on.
It's
rougher.
More rough.
No, I think he maybe. I just don't like the way it sounds. It really rubs me the wrong way. Rougher is a freaking word.
Rougher rubbed the wrong way.
Jared, what did you think of the freaking episode?
Pega said it best. It's one of those episodes where the grass is greener on the other side. Ikigai learns that, you know, there's a lot of hard work to being a superhero, and Riku goes to work like everybody else. It's an episode.
Yeah, okay. You weren't the only one having a hard time with this one. I kind of marinated on this one probably the most after rewatching it recently, because I knew it was saying some stuff, and maybe it's the most profound of the episodes that we're talking about today.
Yeah.
But it was kind of taking me a while to get there. You know, it's an episode about finding one's identity and being comfortable in that identity regardless of what others think. In this particular case, Riku is finding life as an ultra warrior difficult. For numerous reasons, but the fact others think he might be an enemy because of how closely he resembles Belial, a feature in the design I love, by the way, hits hard because, you know, who hasn't been self-conscious of their looks growing up in high school?
But well, overall, I certainly haven't.
Well, but overall, I think the stress of being, you know, a little star hunting world-saving savior against monsters out to kill him on a planet that doesn't trust him was really ravaging Riku in this one. And, you know, it was comedic seeing him go to work, but I think the constant bogging down of being an ultra warrior, and later on Leha's insinuation that these monsters are after him, leading to that very somber standing around doing nothing won't get me anywhere. Really, really brought to light the stress on the character. And I enjoyed that aspect a lot.
Yeah, I think the most profound thing about this episode actually came at the end, where Ikigai is talking with Riku. And he's like, you know, the reason I work, the reason I do what I do is to provide for my family. And, you know, the reason you've got to find your reason to be Jid, which, you know, saving the world, you know, yeah, that's always priority, but you got to find, I guess, the what he was trying to get at, a more intimate reason to fight, to keep the fight going. And I don't know. It's a concept that throughout the series I kind of struggle with, because I don't think he really, at least in these few episodes that we are covering today, I don't think he really finds that. He always just has that little kid attitude of, I'm a superhero. And maybe he, we'll get to it, but maybe he finds a reason in episode 10. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, I'm with you. I'm definitely with you on Iguri's line. When he asks, what makes you work so hard? I actually wrote down, I'd say it's because of the precious things I want to protect, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he started caring more about the town and the earth because even long after he's gone, his daughter will still be there.
Yeah, and then he picks up a piece of trash.
Right, then he picks up, yeah. Right. So it's the little things, and now the big things he gets to do, which makes him the perfect Ultraman. Really, the perfect host for Ultraman Zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Which, yeah, you know, we were joking earlier about him in when he first becomes Ultraman, or fused with an Ultraman, but this is the characteristics that Zero saw in him to begin with.
Right. These are the characteristics of Ultraman, and we get to that even more so in the next episode. We'll discuss that in a bit. But we, you know, the show goes back to these lines. In a few episodes here. And I think that's a major aspect of what makes a great Ultra host. We'll say
right.
That. Because it's almost this innocent, I don't want to say naive, but innocent need to care for others selflessly.
Right.
That makes these Ultra Warriors attracted to these hosts. I like that aspect, and I have to agree with you on the insinuation that he doesn't really find it here, or Riku doesn't really find his reason for protecting
right.
the Earth here. Yeah. I feel like, you know, through the power of sentimentality, we get the Jeed Claw.
Oh, right, yeah. And then... what was it? Not Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, Deus Ex Machina. No. It's totally Deus Ex Machina. No, that Jeed Claw came out of nowhere. It came.
It
out
really
of
does. Aw.
He's you know like, what? He's right. One day I will find that thing to protect. Look, a new weapon, and this will satisfy that Bandai mandate. And I'm. It's not that like I think I don't. Like the weapon or anything. I just don't think it was.
No, I don't like the weapon.
You don't like the weapon?
I don't like the weapon.
You don't? Okay. Well,
see, like, okay. I keep wanting it to spin. Like, it's just a claw. I keep wanting it to, like, later on, he does the, he actually does a move where he spins. But I want the claw to actually spin. I want it to do grab and just spin somebody around. That's just me.
Okay, here's my thing with it. I think it's a more creative looking weapon than what we've had in the past with some of these Ultra Warriors. And I like it infinitely more than that fat round sword that Orb used in the prior series.
Don't even get me started on that sword.
The most...
That thing could be a shield.
Combat inert weapon you could use. Because I hated watching Ultraman Orb, and he's like trying to like, you know, sword play with this thing, but it's clearly too heavy.
That's a thing. I mean, some of this stuff looks cool, but then it gets to a point where it's just like, okay... You're going a little too absurd.
Which is fine. I'm fine with absurdity, but I also would like some form of...
Normalcy?
Pragmatism. It was... The orb caliber was too, it was just too bulky to be used. It's not very practical.
You know what it reminds me of?
Hmm.
Animaniacs. Will Marotti, turn. Tell us the lesson that we should learn.
But by comparison, the Gide Claw, I mean, it's smaller, it's easily maneuverable. He can, like, you know, become a giant corkscrew with it. It's, I don't know. I like the Gide Claw. I think all the Bandai mandates are a little much. I'll be honest. The you know, we cut to Riku actually, you know, pressing buttons on the claw, and I'm thinking, yeah, am I watching a Bandai commercial?
That's,
but see, and that's, I am, like,
that's part
I
of
I am watching, yeah, a Bandai commercial.
I mean, Power Rangers and Zords. I mean, you're watching, right, the toys.
Right.
But that's probably why I don't like the claw. Because, well, that's, I mean, for that reason, that's why I don't like most of the Gide weapons, because you're sitting there watching them play with the toy, and then, you know, 2 minutes later, we actually get the fight sequence.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I got you. I don't want this to turn into a, I'm complaining about Bandai mandates. I know that they're going to be there for pretty much eternity. These shows are used to sell toys. We need to get over that. But in that line of thinking, I think the Gide Claw is one of the better ones. I just think it's a little interesting that it was used by the Acro Smasher, because it's kind of a violent looking weapon, and the Acro Smasher Cosmos using
thank you.
So I don't know.
Now you ready for me to be a total hypocrite? Yeah, I love the Bandai mandates.
Okay. No. All right, so what,
like, all right,
you said you don't like the Gide Claw. You said you don't like watching the commercial.
I don't like the actual physical weapon, but, like, watching him play with it is the Power Rangers thing. It's like, you gotta, you know, they made fun of it in Kira Ranger, where they're morphing and then the villains start doing the dance with them. You know, it's a necessity for Super Sentai, and I think you can't have Super Sentai without the Bandai mandate.
You can't have Ultraman without it these days either.
But there's something about the actual claw. I don't even care about the, like, even the Bandai part, I do not like. I still want the thing to spin.
Well, I think we've about clawed this one out enough. Let's,
Episode 7 is Sacrifice. We meet Kay and his, unpronounceable first name. The enigmatic sci-fi author invites Riku, Leha, and the Irigawa family to special lecture regarding his newest book, but things aren't what they seem, and seems to spell trouble for Ultraman Zero. You know, this is kind of an episode where we were talking about, you know, Irigawa's willingness to be an Ultraman, and the links you have to take, the sacrifices you have to take, because, I mean, literally, bad dude, threatens his whole family, threatens everybody in the room. And he's just like, yeah, in order to save them, you gotta die.
Yeah, I can't think of an instance, and I haven't seen every Ultraman series, but I've seen a lot. I can't think of an instance right now where a villain specifically threatens family members.
Right.
And kind of like almost holds them for ransom in a weird way. But this was eerie because, you know, the family didn't know they were being threatened.
No.
Right. It was really interesting. The onstage scene between Zero, or Zero's Igaguri and Kay. It was a clever way for the villain to sort of gloat in front of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I call it a Lokiism. You know, he wants an audience.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's all
this villain is. He wants an audience. Let's be honest.
Well, he's serving Belial.
Yeah,
he seems to have a love for serving Belial.
But he always, like later on in the series, he gets very theatrical.
That's true. Well, we'll get to that. But here, I love the idea. He's kind of, he's masquerading as an author who's trying to write Ultraman Zero's final chapter. I mean.
Well, on top of that, not only the final chapter, he seems to be writing Zero's entire life.
Well, he was there. They were referencing the second Ultraman Zero movie.
Yeah, I noticed that.
The Return of Belial in that book, except the way he writes it is
Zero's the
villain. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and he's just got this, like, I love this, like, mustache twirling villain moment he has at the beginning where he says, "The null numeral that renders nothingness itself zero." I was like, you know, he's twisting Zero's name into essentially what he wants him to become. Nothing, literally zero. Yeah, I mean, I think the setup is so good in this one. And the onstage scene, like I mentioned, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's lots of tension there. And I think it was great to bring back Galactitron for this one. And I don't know if you, have you watched Ultraman Orb?
I have.
Yeah, you have. Okay, so
we were just making fun of the sword.
Right. Galactitron was first in Ultraman Orb two-parter, and again mm-hmm. in the movie, and he's just a vicious monster mech, whatever you want to call him. So it was very believable that Zeed was going to have trouble with him because we've already seen another Ultraman have issues with this one.
Yeah, out of all the kaiju in this series, even in Orb, he's probably my favorite. He's got a very
he's up there.
He's got a very Kiryu-esque face.
I knew you were going to go. Yeah, I was thinking Kiryu. Yeah, I really like his design. I like his powers.
Yeah.
And
I like his beam. Whenever it impacts something, it mm-hmm. like takes it out of a dimension. And then it implodes or explodes. It's got
and what's even more telling is it can kind of go Terminator on you. And what I mean by that is even when the Terminator is damaged, it's still horrifying. It's unstoppable. And here you had kind of its like head tail thing and one of its arms blown off.
And it kept
going. It was unstoppable, right?
Yeah.
I was very impressed with the decision to bring back Galactitron for such a high stakes situation. Mm-hmm. And that situation it culminates to the sacrifice, the name of the episode, right?
Right.
And I kind of want to build on a moment what we were talking about in the prior episode. Coming to the concept of sacrifice, I'm always profoundly struck by acts of sacrifice in fiction because it's not something that can really be demanded. It's merely a choice based on love, arguably the most powerful act of love. Ultra warriors are already life-giving beings rewarding selflessness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And often those selfless acts are some form of self-sacrifice. And so when we see Zero taking the blast to protect Leto, and by extension Riku and the others, there's a sense of coming full circle with the concept. Because Zero's act here, and Ultraman King, the decision to surrender themselves for others, is very second nature to them in this show.
Yeah.
And while you and I both know there's no way Zero's gone, I think the integrity of these themes really keep the moments honest and dramatic. I think this was one of the stronger episodes so far because of it. It's definitely my favorite episodes of the ones we're going to talk about today. But yeah, there's just a lot going for it. The theme, the very tense scene on the stage. And in addition to other things, Ozawa's performance as Leto Igigiri. I mean,
the scene where he's holding the book And he's walking away, but Zero's like, no, let's sit here and read this.
No, I want to read. Yeah. I don't want to, yeah.
it's very comical. And then Zero puts him into a flip, and they're standing on his head. He's like, why are you doing that? I don't know.
But we talked about this in the last bonus episode we did. The switch this guy has.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
I loved it when he went on stage, and he's playing Zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
and yeah, I love got
the glasses on. He's playing Leto. It's so tremendous. I really do think the show has some of the best actors.
Oh, in, without a doubt,
in an Ultraman series. Yeah, no, it's so good.
Yeah, I love when he's Irigawa. He's just got like such a like sweet, innocent face. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the glasses come off, he narrows his brow. He's got a very stern look. He looks like a completely different person.
He looks like a badass.
He does.
He looks like a badass. Like he slings his glasses off and he gets all serious. I'm like, oh no, that there's Zero.
Yeah.
No, there's Zero. I'm very.
It's a very distinct switch, and it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you pay attention, when he's getting hit by the blast. You can actually see Zero leave his body. Like, as...
Yes, yeah.
As and then Zero... Look back. As Zero is looking back, you see, like, that switch. But it's a very...
It's you mean a very, the acting?
Like, yes,
like, the acting. His reaction to Zero yes. coming out. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, it's okay. It's a very... I want to say subtle, but very impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost being... forced out of him.
He's good. He's yeah. really good.
He is really good.
I mean, but yeah, this is my favorite episode of the ones we'll be talking about today, easily.
I think I have to agree with you. I don't know. But out of the ones today, this is probably number one.
Well, since we left on a cliffhanger, let's go to episode 8, Going Beyond Fate. After Zero sacrifices his life to protect his friends, it's up to Riku to take on Galactitron and protect the city.
Part 2.
A few things that stuck out to me. Riku kept being told how many hours he had left before he could transform again.
Right.
Kind of giving us an idea of how it works once he fades back into his human form. And I really loved the moment between Riku and Leha when Leha accused Riku of not preparing. And Riku said, I went through 17 different scenarios to defeat Galactitron. She goes, okay. And out of 17, 17 failed. And she goes, that's all of them. And he just smiles and was like, yeah. They both smile. Like it was kind of an appreciation.
Yeah.
That they, you know, she liked that he prepared, even though it was against, you know, all odds. And he, yeah, it was a good moment. It was a really good moment. Otherwise, I gotta say, I don't think this episode quite sticks the landing.
No.
I think the last episode was excellent. It was just a fantastic, high stakes piece of storytelling. But then, once again, the power of sentiment brings back Zero. And then Deus Machina gives Ultraman Hikari, gives Ultraman Zero a new form.
I love the
longest transformation sequence.
I love the fact that it wasn't even sentiment that brought out a new transformation. It was just, oh, hey, I found you. Here's some new stuff. It's like, I've been looking for you. Package delivery.
Well,
but yes, it is the longest transformation. Like, you sit there and go, what are they doing in the background? Are they just sitting there watching him as Zero mentally does this?
Yeah, I think I finished my 2022 taxes during this scene. It just went on and on and on. And it's the same problem I had with Ultraman R&B. Is that they're just a regular transformation sequence.
It takes forever.
This was a nightmare. And I'm glad they abbreviate it from here on out.
Yeah. Just simplify it by two capsules.
And even that's too long, but
yes,
but
it is.
I'm glad they agreed.
First, he's got to put the glasses on a fusion riser, and then he's got to put the capsules.
No, we don't have to go through the.
I mean, it's just. But yeah, you know, the things I want to point out in this episode, acting is phenomenal from everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really feel for these characters, Irigali especially. I think the fact that what I like about this episode is Irigali kind of has that Riku moment that we both loved in our first bonus episode, where he turns to run away and he stops and he says, "Let go of my leg." And Pega replies, "I'm not holding your leg. This must be what you want to do." Irigali's packing up with his family, and it drags on a little, but as he's packing up with his family, he realizes that, you know, he should be somewhere else. He should be fighting, even though he has nothing to contribute. Like Leal pointed out, you know, she carries a sword, but she can't fight the giant monster. And I think I appreciate that, but, you know, power of sentiment brings Zero back.
You know, as you're talking about this, something occurred to me. Okay, so he gives up the glasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to come back for them. And once he gets them back, then the color returns, and Zero says, "You need to, if we're going to be partners, you need to decide 30 minutes earlier."
Yeah.
Do you think Zero was in there the whole time? He was just waiting for Leto to make the decision.
Right decision.
Yeah. Do you think this was kind of a test, maybe? Because it's within character for Zero to say you need to make your decision 30 minutes earlier. But at the same time, could he just have been waiting in there?
It's I mean, it's a catch 22. Because, you know, not catch 22, but, you know, if he sacrificed himself and the glasses went dormant, did he know he could withstand that blast? Was this really a test for Irigali instead of... a sacrifice.
Thus making the sacrifice less impactful. Yeah. I don't know. That's true. It's probably just sentiment.
Let's just chalk it up to sentiment.
But I did like how the show called back to what Leto said a couple episodes prior about how he wants to protect the world for the sake of his loved ones.
Right.
But that desire being what brings Zero back does feel like a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's just a trope of the genre, and I know I need to get over it, but it's just that the prior episode was so good. I was hoping the second part would be
on par.
Equal footing. I did appreciate, though, in the moment that, like, Zero and Leto are reunited, it looks like Leto transforms on his own. Because up to this point, Zero kind of like takes over his body. He's always saying, "I needed to borrow your body for a moment." And Zero transforms. But it looks like here, Leto decided that he was going to be the one to really make the decision to go for it, which I liked.
Yeah, which is something I kind of wanted to point out. I guess I missed my chance in a previous episode. You know, as soon as they get ready to take the blast, Zero points out, "You're shaking." And, you know, that's part of, I don't know if that's part of Leto's character just being like, "Yeah, I don't want to be here." Or if that's him saying, you know, because it's Zero at that point hold in his body. So it's like, I don't know if Zero's holding him there or Irigali is there with him. But once Zero leaves his body, he still stands there. He still remains.
Right.
And I think that is a subtle, you know, growing moment that we see reflected in this episode where he chooses to transform on his own.
Right. And I think that's where the title, the, you know, Beyond Fate, Going Beyond Fate comes from. And it's why Zero Beyond is named the form that it is. Yeah, like I like how like Zero's fate, according to an author, Kay, was to die, right? In the previous episode. But Leto had other plans, and his fate to become Leto Iriguri's fate to become an Ultraman because he was chosen is something he's no longer satisfied with. Now he wants to protect the world too, just like he talked about in the first episode we discussed. So he's moved past it as well. And it really is all very beautiful sentiment and clearly life-giving sentiment. I'm just, you know, left scratching my head why Ultraman Hikari didn't stick around to lend a hand.
Package delivery. FedEx.
I'm just sitting there going, oh, thanks. You want to stick around for this?
might need you. Did you field test this new fusorizer by chance? Are you sure it's working?
But yeah, no, I really like the Zero Beyond and what it means for Leto Iriguri and Zero himself. They went beyond their expressed fate and became something bigger together. Again, it just comes down to the writing. We need less Deus Ex Machina in this show and more, you know, explanation as to why Hikari is now FedEx.
But, you know, this leads me into a question that I actually had about the episode and thus far, like in the remainder of these episodes that we're covering. Does Zero just become like OG, OP, OP, not OG? Like,
okay,
is it, I hate to see this because it's called G, but is G really needed at this point?
So it's interesting. I wasn't sure if we were going to get into this yet. First of all, I was going to say, wow, Zero gets another form more powerful than the Ultimate Zero form, which I would have a fundamental problem with. But there's actually nowhere does it say that the Zero Beyond form is actually more powerful than the Ultimate Zero form.
Well, but what I'm saying is he's more powerful than the title character at this point.
Yes, yes. And we can also have the debate, you know, is should Zero have been in the show? Does he ever feel shoehorned in there? Was it necessary for him to be in the show? Does it take away from Ultraman Geed, essentially? And so far, I mean, maybe it's just the fact that I really do like Zero. And I feel like if you're going to be working with Belial as the main villain, you kind of need him in there. But I don't think it's all unnecessary. Because, okay, so Zero gets a new form here. We get to sell more toys, and we get a cool new form to watch in battle. And he seems more powerful than Geed at this point. Great, fantastic. But being Geed's show, you also don't want to, you know, blow the Geed wad too early, right?
Yeah.
And we know Geed's going to get more power-ups along the way, right? To kind of surpass whatever Zero has. So I'm kind of okay with Zero getting a new form. You almost expect it. You certainly want it, given the story he has with Leto and just how influential he is in Geed's life. But I think we're getting it early enough in the show that it won't take away from Geed in the long run. Does that make any sense?
Oh, okay. See, I mean, I don't know. This is where you come in, because you have more experience with Ultraman and Zero in particular, and this is my first Geed show, or Ultraman show, so.
Yeah.
Backstory. I guess I just need the context.
Well, you've seen the Zero movies at least, but
I've seen some of them.
Yeah, I think it's a valid question from a storytelling standpoint. I think, you know, you don't want to just shoehorn a cameo in there to make people want to watch a show. You want it to actually matter, right?
Yeah.
And I think this works. Okay. I do think this works overall. I think the Deus Ex Machina is questionable, but I do think in the grand scheme of things, it works.
Let's move on to episode 9, The Sword of an Oath. Leto's daughter Mayu is affected by a little star that lets her teleport. It's up to Zeed and Zero to protect her, while Leia confronts Kay.
First things first, I think Leto's daughter having a little star seems a little bit easy, but the opportunity is also too good to pass up. I get why the writers went this route.
Yeah, the thing with this disc is it's very Irigaray heavy, which I'm not unhappy with. I'm just, no. It's a little Irigaray heavy. Which
Irigaray is, Leto is a fantastic character. I'm glad they do spend time with him.
And I think this disc is where we see a lot of his development, with him talking about wanting to protect his family and stepping into the role of a hero. Whereas, you know, the first few episodes, he was the unwilling participant. This is him actually stepping into the role of a hero and learning, like in what he learned in the first episode here. You know, it's not all fun and games. That aspect, I enjoyed this episode, but you're right. It seemed very convenient that his daughter had a little star.
Yeah, but knowing the type of character that Leto is, I think it was worth, you know, going that route for.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't expect it to end up being a Leha episode. And this is definitely an episode I've been waiting for, because I love Leha, and up until this point, she's kind of just been a brooding support system for Riku.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, but as it turns out, she has a sort of typical superhero backstory. Her parents were killed by Kay, and she's sought vengeance ever since. A couple of things spring to mind about this. First is that in recent episodes, she talked about what she would do if she were fated to be Ultraman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or blessed with those powers. And second, isn't it interesting that this is so close to an episode we already watched about sacrifice? Because basically everything that has led up to this episode is the antithesis of Leia's quest for revenge.
Yeah.
Right? Revenge is for the selfish and the entitled, as opposed to sacrifice, which is an act of selflessness. And we've also examined that the Ultra Warriors embrace the act of sacrifice over anything. So she was never going to be fated to have those powers due to her quests for vengeance.
Right.
She launches herself headfirst into everything being an Ultra Warrior is not about. And that juxtaposition frames not just her character, but the themes of the franchise. It's an excellent case study in what is real power and heroism versus a kind of off-brand perception of it. And I want to say, everything I said makes her seem like an awful character, but she's not. She's actually interesting because of all this. And of course, it's easy to have empathy for her, seeing as the main villain killed her parents.
Right.
So I really, really like her, and I really like what we learned about her here and how different she is from Riku and Zero.
Yeah, you're saying how episode 7 is probably your favorite of this. Mm-hmm. This one is probably mine.
Second for me. Yeah.
Because of everything you mentioned about her. Especially the part where she's like, well, you know, if I had these powers, blah, blah, blah. And that you see how, with the links she was going to go, that if she had those powers, it would have been over before it would have begun. She would have killed him on the spot.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that that something, a voice, which I'm going to assume was her parents, told her to stop.
I don't know.
Maybe. We might see later on.
Yeah, I think the fact that she hasn't killed Kay keeps her
story very interesting.
Well, it also keeps her, I want to use the word pure, but keeps her from unraveling into something darker. Well, just turning into something darker. And, you know, we play with these themes a lot in the Batman franchise. I'm thinking of Mask of the Phantasm in particular.
Oh, yeah.
The juxtaposition between Bruce and Andrea. And here, like I said, the juxtaposition is she's really walking that line, right? She's not... The show doesn't say it outright, but she really represents something that the Ultra Warriors wouldn't gravitate towards.
Right.
Or gravitate to bond with, at least. Because she's right there. She's right on the edge of killing Kay.
Mm-hmm.
And then the voice stops her. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think she still kind of walks that line even after this episode. But we learn a lot about her, and we know that she's not so far gone into the lie that is revenge to be kind of rescued from it. So
I'll agree with that. The only other thing I had a problem with in this episode is, so apparently Leha had a little star in her when she was younger with her parents. What?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. That just seems to come out of left field.
Well, she just hasn't told anyone. I mean, again, everything we've learned about her here is pretty new.
Yeah, but I mean, in her discovery of, you know, little stars and them tracking them, wouldn't you think that she would have been like, oh, by the way, I had one when I was little, and it went to a giant red horned monster.
Also, I'm glad they keep bringing Skull Gamora back. He's awesome.
Yes, he is.
I think, well, again, how much of her backstory has she told to anyone? She told a child because, I don't know, she could. I'm sure if we went back and watched the episodes, we might see some like shots of her, some glances or gestures from her that might be indicative of recognition when they realize what the little stars are. But it doesn't shock me that she would have kept the fact that she had one in her from everyone else. That just seems in line with her character.
I don't know. It just for me, it came out of left field.
Minor note, love the fact that Zero feels that Mayu is his daughter too.
Oh, amazing. I even love the comment, no, she's my daughter. And then Zero.
Close enough. And the thing is, Leto doesn't even mind. He just kind of grins.
He just smirks. He's like, okay. Touché, sir.
I like that. I really like that. Yeah. All right.
All right, let's get our groaning out now.
Yeah, last episode of the night, episode 10, I Read Minds. The AIB brings a specialist in from off-world to deal with the rampaging I'm calling it Xandreas.
I'm sure
that's not right.
I'm calling it...
Xandreas sounds so funny, I don't not want to say it.
I'm calling it Baby Misformed Rodan.
And Moa has her hands full dealing with the brutally truthful psychic. So this is my least favorite episode on the day.
This should be everybody's least favorite episode. I don't care if you haven't watched Jeed. This is your least favorite episode.
Well, no. Okay. So I kind of bemoaned we had another Moa episode. And while I don't love this one, I don't dislike it.
Blasphemy.
No. Listen, we had a run of some pretty dour episodes for the show before this, and the whole monster with a crush in outer space story mirroring Moa's feelings for Riku, that was hilarious. Okay, yeah. I mean, Ultraman, like, the great thing about Ultraman is it will switch genres on a dime. Sometimes it'll be really straight-faced, sometimes it'll just be, like, bombastic fun. Other times, it's just a comedy. And and this was, I enjoyed this for the most part. You know, how do we make MOA more withstandable? Well, we introduced a more annoying guest character. this, to be fair, this was the low point of the episode for me. The alien is pretty much giving away what Riku and MOA are.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't click with anyone. But I am glad they found out who they were this episode. They don't drag this out to the point of frustration like they did in Ultraman Orb.
Oh god.
You know. that whole show, the supporting characters should have figured that out within 10 episodes. Here.
Now, within the first episode, are you kidding me?
I'll give him.
He picks her up and jumps into the air. Like,
yeah, no, granted. No, that drives me nuts. But
oh, you must be an alien. Nope, normal human.
But here, okay, 10 episodes in, they find out. I'm glad. All right, they should have. It should have all clicked earlier in the episode, granted. But they still find out. And that made me feel a little bit better about the episode. And I'll give the juxtaposition between Riku and MOA not putting it together with Riku not putting together MOA's feelings for him kind of an interesting piece of writing, because there's humor in the fact that they're not figuring out who they are, who they work for, but then it's also, it's mirroring the fact that Riku isn't figuring out that MOA has feelings for him. He's just one of those kind of like completely oblivious anime characters with all these girls who have crushes on him and he doesn't understand, right? Gohan during the Buu saga.
Oh my god. You made that connection. You made that connection. Wow.
Am I wrong?
No, you're not.
Am I wrong?
You're not.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I spent last episode defending MOA. I'm kind of regretting that.
I like her more here, though. I don't understand how you could defend her in the last episode where she's completely unlikable, mostly unlikable, to this episode where she's, you know, they've pulled her in a little bit.
I don't know. I just didn't. I mean,
she's
not
crying in this episode. Once she like, you know, trips and falls. I mean, come on.
They play her up. I mean, regardless of her character, I felt that she's just played up even more in this one. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they play her up because the guest host alien is so played up, literally to the point where she's blowing kisses at everybody. The whole ditzy mind reading thing, everybody should be used to this. It didn't work for me. I get that I was trying to be comical, but that kind of made me roll my eyes. And, you know, as much as I agree with the whole, when Mayu comes in, they're talking about princes and all that, and the alien lies to her, or is straight up honest with her.
Tells her the truth, yeah.
Yeah, tells her the truth. I mean, I got that. I got what she was trying to say, but for some reason, it was a little much for me. I mean, I don't know if
how
it
so?
Was. I don't know if it was the acting, or like she was trying to put her feelings onto Mayu. I just
project them.
The scolding of the alien felt a little much to me. And then when she pulls out the megaphone and she starts screaming at the alien. Well, okay, well, first of all, I will say that
isn't
hysterical.
The monster. She's screaming at the monster.
She's screaming
right?
at the monster, which yeah. I will say is hysterical. But what kills it for me is she holds that last word for like 2 minutes. And that just annoys the crap out of me.
She did hold it kind of long, yeah.
And then, but I loved how Zero mirrored that and pulled out his own megaphone.
Oh, yeah.
Even though they're like 2 feet apart, he pulls out a megaphone.
And the female monster head.
Yeah, eyelashes. that was probably a little much. I got it was trying to be comical, but that was a little much. Because, you know, all right, I will tell you why it was much for me. Because the whole time, the monster's like, she doesn't know I exist, all of a sudden. And, you know, that's why he's crying. But all of a sudden, he goes back into space, and she's like, oh my gosh, I love you. It's like, that's a very odd turn of events.
Well, maybe, JR, in monster speak, he told her that he had feelings for her, and she had feelings for him the entire time. And they got
she
together.
Was the first one you to know? Blush.
Well, yeah, he had told her his feelings,
but he didn't say anything. She cracked open from her egg.
He roared. That's gotta be saying something.
That's all right. That's how I'm gonna find my next girlfriend. I'm gonna run up to her and I'm gonna roar
and screech.
I'm gonna have Rebecca teach me the pterodactyl.
Oh my gosh!
And I'm going to run up. I'm gonna get so excited that my words turn into a high pitched screech, and she'll just know that I care for her.
They're probably lining up at your door right now, man. You gotta be careful.
Side note. I loved Mayu in this episode. I loved how she like shook her pigtails. Yeah. I loved how she shook her pigtails and they were yeah. I love her little tantrum.
I don't think this episode was that bad. It was definitely the weakest we've watched of this run. But I liked this Mo episode more than the last one.
Teach their own.
Well, that said, I'm really excited about going into the next episode with you. That's when things really start ramping up. But we're going to have to wait until the next time we do this a bonus episode.
What is the next episode?
Well,
the Jeet identity. Mm-hmm. Makes his move. Catcher Riku reveals the truth behind his sword. Ooh, it is a good episode.
Right.
I remember this one. Oh, this is a very good episode. Well, guys, I think that wraps it up for another bonus episode of Jeed. So, listen, the reason we have decided to give Dave and Rebecca a little break is we have something in the works going on in the background.
Yes.
GJ, myself, Dave, and Rebecca have been plotting. We've been talking amongst ourselves, and we are on the verge of very big things. And we want to remind you that you should keep tuning in to the Drift Space, particularly these bonus episodes, because we might be dropping hints about what is to come. Mm-hmm. I know I'm very excited. I know GJ was the one who got the ball rolling on this, so I know he's excited.
Right. We'll announce, we're going to have 3 bonus episodes, and by the end of the 3rd bonus episode, we will announce a little something-something. Hopefully after that, be on our regularly scheduled show with all 4 of us back together.
In the meantime, if you've liked my ramblings, I am JR. You can find me over on Twitter at littleman_says1. I also have the Instagram where I do cosplays. You can find me there at littlemancosplay.
And I'm G. You can find me on Twitter at gmanandmysterioid. And check out my Substack, Deferential Wrath of a Rusting Markalite Cannon, at markalite.substack.com.
And we, in fact, have been the Drift Space. Or at least 2 of us have been. If you like our show, take a look at us at bit.ly/TDSlinks. Where you can find us on all your favorite podcatchers. If you dug this episode, make sure you share it with a friend. I know I enjoy this episode. I enjoy talking G. Do you enjoy talking G?
I love G. I love Ultraman G. I love Ultraman.
I love Ultraman too.
That's how I want to do more of these with you, man. This has been fun.
I get, you know, like 5-year-old JR when he pulls out and standing around doing nothing won't get you nowhere. And then you do the miming, you go, I go, we go. Anyway, a little off topic.
Do you get excited watching the Bandai commercials, JR? Is that what you?
I do. I watched the Bandai commercial so much that I felt the need to buy a Fusion Riser.
Do you actually have a Fusion Riser?
I have a Fusion Riser. It's very fun. That. Anyway, if you like this show, retweet, repost, rewind us. You can also say hello to us on all your socials at the Drift Space. We always say hi back. And as always, we want to thank you for playing along and listening to this episode. And remember, my friends, always stay strapped. You go.
I go.
We go.